today on Edinburgh Radio News.
The movies give us all the illusion of knowing somebody very well and being intimately involved with them.
A celebrity death can affect you more than you think. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Edinburgh Radio News for Tuesday, December 3rd, 2013. I'm Ani Yukar. Los Angeles could get a little more colorful. The City Council passed an ordinance that would allow residents in Council Districts 1, 9, and 14 to paint murals on the walls of their homes. Emmanuel Martinez reports.
Evan Meyer started Beautify Earth with the purpose of beautifying Lincoln Boulevard in Santa Monica. His goal was to enhance the community by painting murals.
Art has the power to transform economies, communities, and each other.
Prior to today, he was restricted to painting on the walls of businesses. But as of today, Myers and Angelinos who live in South LA, Boyle Heights, and Highland Park will be able to paint murals on the side of their homes. The City Council passed this ordinance in a 14-1 vote. Bernard Parks was the lone council member who opposed. In a statement, he says communities should have the option to allow or restrict murals. Some individuals support art on walls of businesses, but not on homes. Nina Royal of Tahunga is one of those. She doesn't oppose art, but she is concerned that the anamorphous definition of art and murals can invite graffiti.
And who's to determine what's a mural and what isn't, what's art and what is not?
Another one of Royal's concerns is that art can sometimes send offensive messages.
Ones that are political, that make statements contrary to your views, I find those offensive, that you have to look at day in, day out. Ones that are religious in nature.
Meyer paints a lot of murals, but he is careful about the message his art sends. He says art with certain affiliations can sometimes cause problems.
You know, sometimes a strong cultural identity brings about graffiti, it brings about an antagonistic attitude from a culture that may have been opposing in the past.
But art that has a broad audience has greater power.
Sometimes if you put out art that is more unifying and less differentiating, there's a greater chance for success for the art to create peace ultimately.
Art will bring more personality to residential areas, but it remains to be seen whether or not residents wish for their neighborhoods to come to life. Emmanuel Martinez, Edinburgh Radio News.
Standardized testing has become an increasingly important part of students' lives. But as Andy Vasoyan reports, new test results show American students still aren't keeping up with their teenage counterparts overseas.
The Program for International Student Assessment places American students in the middle of 65 countries participating in their 2013 test. 500,000 15-year-olds across the world were tested in science, math, and reading, with teens in Shanghai taking the number one spot. American teens were ranked 26th in math, 21st in science, and 17th in reading, scores that Education Secretary Arne Duncan called a picture of educational stagnation. USC Associate Professor of Education Policy Morgan Polikoff explained some of the problems.
There's no question that we have some teacher quality issues. We have high rates of teacher turnover. Poverty and inequality are huge problems as well. I mean, the fact is that among developed countries, we're the most unequal, and that's certainly a problem given the high correlation of socioeconomic status with student outcomes.
However, Polikoff also says that a successful implementation of the upcoming Common Core standards might help push test scores higher. Andy Vasoyan, Edinburgh Radio News.
Black Friday and Cyber Monday are 2 days known for getting great deals. And now, with the creation of the Giving Tuesday movement, there is one day devoted to charity. Several Los Angeles-based partners of the movement are hoping to encourage more people to get into the giving spirit. Madeline Newells reports.
Last year's Giving Tuesday resulted in more than $10 million in online donations to organizations ranging from nonprofits to cultural centers and universities. According to GivingTuesday.org, the movement was created in response to the hyper-consumerism of Black Friday and to put the giving back into the holiday season. Several Los Angeles-based organizations say they are happy to see that more and more donors are participating in the movement.
But already today we have seen people increasing their previous gifts. We've seen gifts from first-time donors, people who have never given before. So we're definitely optimistic about, you know, the amount of money that we're going to raise today.
That was Lucy Richardson, Assistant Director of the Annual Fund for Occidental College. Participating organizations say the movement is largely driven by social media efforts. Alec Vicari-Epstein is a social media and communication intern at Chrysalis, a nonprofit that helps homeless and low-income individuals get back on their feet.
For the most part, I'd say we're using Giving Tuesday as a tool to supplement our end-of-the-year fundraising campaign. We noticed that it was a great opportunity. This is the first year we've been associated with it. We, you know, learned about it online and through the nonprofit network in L.A.
The L.A. County Bicycle Coalition is another organization taking part in Giving Tuesday. Education Director Colin Bogart hopes it will raise money for a program that provides bike lights.
So we've been promoting Operation Firefly and specifically today Giving Tuesday through our usual communication channels, which is, you know, really today has mostly been about posting things on our Facebook page and through our Twitter feed.
The environmental group Heal the Bay is participating in Giving Tuesday for a second time. Communication Director Matthew King tells us that this year's movement is already more profitable.
First got involved with Giving Tuesday last year, and it was a little bit of an experiment for us. And the results this year are much more robust than last year, and I think people are getting used to the whole concept of the day.
These organizations hope that today will inspire a season of giving, not just consuming. Madeline Uhls, Annenberg Radio News.
Sarah Zahedi contributed to that report. Christmas is around the corner, and every year tens of thousands of kids write letters to Santa Claus. Little do they know that in some cases, it's not Santa's elves wrapping their gifts. As Karen Lynn reports, you could be the one to make their wishes come true.
Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas!
Santa Claus was on hand today at the LA District Post Office on South Central Avenue, where volunteers were reading letters to Santa, like this one.
Dear Santa, my name is Alex John, and I have been a good boy. But most of the time, I would like Santa to bring me presents for Christmas, including Spider-Man scooter, Thomas the Tank Engine, sweet chocolates, and a football. Thank you, Santa.
Every year, tens of thousands of letters are addressed to Santa Claus at the North Pole. But their first stop is the post office, the place where dreams really come true. It's part of a program called Operation Santa. El Santos, postmaster of Los Angeles, is happy to welcome the project back.
Well, today is exciting for us because it's the 101st year of the Operation Santa, which really is about giving. It's amazing how many people actually come out and read some of the letters and respond to some of the letters.
Here is how the program works. If you wish to be a secret Santa, you can go to a post office and select one or more letters. The last name and address of the writer will be blocked out for safety reasons. You can fulfill the kids' wishes and buy presents on their list. You bring the gifts back to the post office, which will deliver the goods to the child. More than 440 people adopted the letters in LA last year. Postal spokesperson Richard Marr hopes more volunteers will join the program.
When you read the letters, they just touch your heart. Letters from families and children that need help. You know, kids asking for shoes or school supplies. It makes you really appreciate what you have and want to help others and spread some goodwill this time of the year. It's what it's all about.
It's the families in need that have kept Patrick Reynolds volunteering since 2004. He shares one letter he adopted this year.
Dear Santa, my name is Angela, and I'm a single parent to five children. I struggle every month to have enough food in the house. I want my children to have a nice Christmas. And I would really appreciate your help for food and footwear. It will be a true blessing that they'll be able to have another clean pair of shoes for the new year and enough food to eat. Sincerely, Angela. It's a very moving thing to participate in.
Individuals can go to three district offices in the greater LA area to be part of Operation Santa. The LA office on South Central Avenue, Santa Ana office, and Sierra Coastal office in Santa Clarita. The operation is available on December the 3rd, 5th, 10th, 12th, 17th, and 19th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Kerling, Annenberg Radio News.
A small group of activists in Washington, D.C. have been fasting for 23 days in support of immigration reform. Now they are passing the baton to a new group of hunger strikers. Scores of activists in Los Angeles and California are joining the hunger strike in solidarity. Brianna Sachs spoke to a few LA fasters today.
Kevin Valero took a sip of water at 10 a.m. this morning before joining scores of other immigrant activists across the country in a hunger strike. Valero hasn't seen his father in 2 years. He and his parents are undocumented, so when his father got sick, he had to go back to Mexico.
Since we're not eligible for health care, so I've been living without my father for almost 2 years now. My mom is still, you know, working in the domestic households.
Valero came to Los Angeles with his parents when he was 5 years old and worked hard to succeed in public school. But he had to drop out of the University of Southern California after his freshman year because he could not get federal financial aid.
I was attending but wasn't able to continue due to lack of documents. So that's had me looking at public, you know, universities, community colleges, even though we get, you know, pushed down and thrown down and disrespected and there's a lot of hate against us. It's empowered me to, you know, fight for my rights.
Valero is part of a statewide network of undocumented students who have been fighting for a pathway to citizenship so they can lead a normal life here in the States.
We've been here working, going through education. You know, we're not asking for amnesty or any handouts. We want to prove that we can work our way up to being citizens as well, so we can stop our families from being deported and separated.
75 others from the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, unions, and other advocacy groups across Los Angeles will fast for 24 hours or longer in solidarity with the D.C. fasters. Jorge Murillo Cabrera from the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles says fasting is a peaceful but powerful way to denounce the lack of leadership in Congress on immigration reform.
There have been over 25 fasters in Washington, D.C., over 1,200 throughout the nation. San Francisco is also doing a fast, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Chicago, Miami, and then there's a fast also in New York. This fast is part of a series of activities that Chirla has been conducting to pressure members of Congress locally, especially Republican members of Congress.
GOP lawmakers are split over the idea of providing a pathway to citizenship, but promise they are committed to some type of immigration legislation. California Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy says the current immigration system is broken and that reform will happen, but as a series of bills and not one comprehensive one. Cabrera says that is not the way it should happen. He reminds lawmakers that immigrants and naturalized citizens are an ever-growing community with a lot at stake and the power to vote.
Immigration reform for many people has become more of a social economic necessity rather than a political one. But it does remain apparently a political game for many Republicans in the House of Representatives. And it is to their peril that they're playing that game.
Cabrera is now a naturalized citizen, but undocumented immigrants like Valero and his family say they live every day looking over their shoulders.
It is a struggle, you know, every day knowing that sometimes you don't know if your family members might get picked up simply by driving without a license or jaywalking or, you know, something that is, you know, seemingly harmless that can sweep them into deportation proceedings.
Republicans say immigration reform will be tackled next year, and activists say they will make sure those lawmakers know they will stay hungry till that day comes. Brianna Sachs, Annenberg Radio News.
Don't forget your coats and sweaters, Southern California. Heavy winds are blasting cold air in the Southland tonight and tomorrow. Meteorologists are calling it the cold snap with a wind advisory near the Santa Clarita and San Gabriel Valleys through Wednesday. For tonight's forecast, expect lows to hit 47 degrees and reaching a high of 61 tomorrow. Later on Annenberg Radio News, saying goodbye to a beloved LA restaurant. If you're planning any holiday travel this season, you may pass by an old LA landmark. The Proud Bird restaurant has been a favorite near LAX for decades. But as Catherine Davis reports, the restaurant won't be around much longer.
To one side is the runway of one of the world's busiest international airports. To another side, a buzzing LA freeway. Overhead, a constant parade of landing planes. When you sit here, you're at a crossroads. For many restaurants, the appeal is in the location. For the Proud Bird, location is everything. It's what makes this place unique. It's what's caught the eye of visitors from around the world passing through LA, and it's the thing that has hooked the old-timers, the locals, the regulars who keep coming back for more. Since its beginnings in 1967, a diverse array of diners has paused at this busy intersection to have a meal.
You can walk around on the lawn, see the different aircraft.
It's like coming to your grandparents' house or something.
I call it a family holidays, place.
Holidays, special memories, birthdays of our children and our grandchildren.
It was on Valentine's Day and it was decked out with pink balloons everywhere.
On December 21st, after nearly 50 years of filet mignon dinners, champagne brunches, award banquets, and weddings, the Proud Bird will close its doors. Restaurant owners announced in September that the restaurant would close. Since then, the dining room has been filled with visitors making the pilgrimage back for one last meal.
I hope you enjoyed it today.
Had a great time. Yeah, what a great spot here. I really am good.
Thank you.
The public response to the news of the Proud Bird's closing has been so great that owner John Talachet pushed back the date of closing 1 month. But he says the amount of expensive repairs that need to be done on the property, combined with years of lease disputes, are making it impossible to keep the business running beyond the end of the year.
We decided that with the current condition of the place that it was best to go ahead and close it, even though that's not what we wanted to do.
Talachet owns more than 20 restaurants around the country, but the Proud Bird is special to him. His father, David, was an Army pilot during World War II. The Proud Bird was his vision. The restaurant, which sits on 8 acres of land, has a large lawn with several replica World War II airplanes. Inside, the walls are decked with photos and memorabilia from aviation history. For Talachet, the Proud Bird is the family business, his father's legacy. But the Proud Bird is many things to many people. It's the site of first dates, class reunions, family holidays. Talachet may be the owner, but many customers have come to feel it's their restaurant. Diane Savage was choked up when she paid the restaurant her final visit. She remembered meals with her grandchildren there and holidays with her late husband.
I'll always just remember the food, Ralph, our server, just the memories of why we came. And I'm a great picture taker. I had my girlfriend take some pictures of me by the fireplace, because that was the last place that my husband and I took pictures.
In addition to intimate family memories, some visitors remember the Proud Bird as a place of big social milestones. Clint Simmons is a member of the California Black Airmen's Association. He came out to a Board of Airport Commissioners meeting to voice his support for the restaurant. He says the Proud Bird has become deeply important in LA's black community.
The Proud Bird restaurant was the first restaurant that black and brown people could have an event of this size in the Los Angeles area.
While longtime customers are saddened by the closing of the restaurant, the people who may be most affected by the closure are not the diners, but the ones waiting the tables. The restaurant employs more than 100 people. Many of them have been on staff for decades. Anthony Guizzo has witnessed many changes in his 36 years working at the Proud Bird. Now the restaurant's closure will mean big changes for him.
I don't know if you know where the Buggy Whip is in Westchester. That was my night job, and they closed that a month ago. It's very sad, you know. Just have to dust off your resume and get out there.
Guizzo and his colleagues have served thousands of meals at the Proud Bird over the years. Now, over and over again, as loyal diners come back to pay their respects, they're saying goodbye, serving hundreds of last meals. Sitting still at the center of a busy global intersection, the restaurant has been a stopping point for generations of people. Soon, for all those who have passed through, the Proud Bird will be a memory.
I call it a family special.
Birthdays of our children. Walk around on the lawn, see different aircraft.
It just feels like Thanksgiving.
That was ARN's Catherine Davis. Today, President Obama and his administration started a new initiative to revitalize the promotional campaign for Obamacare. The White House hopes the PR push will increase enrollment before the December 23rd deadline. Amen Oyi Boke has the story.
The Obamacare website has faced its fair share of ups and downs. And after 2 months of seeing technology problems on the website, President Obama has decided to use a new publicity platform.
We're just getting started with the exchanges, just getting started with the marketplaces. So we're not going to walk away from it. If I've got to fight another 3 years to make sure this law works, then that's what I'll do.
The White House today announced a three-week campaign highlighting the benefits of the Affordable Care Act. Obama believes that the public should look at the bigger picture.
I've said very clearly that our poor execution in the first couple months on the website clouded the fact that there are a whole bunch of people who stand to benefit.
The Obamacare website could use some good PR. Annenberg Professor of Public Relations Jerry Swerling says the Obama team should focus on functionality.
What matters now is the evidence. Is it working? Is it closer to 98 or 99 or 100% functional? Are people able to access and shop and price and then commit and do all of the things that this service is supposed to do?
Yesterday marked a day of smooth operation with no major glitches for the website. More than 1 million visitors logged on to the site. But Swerling believes one day might not be enough to change the minds of already doubtful users.
I think I would be incredibly careful about any commitments. Incredibly careful about saying we expect it to be 100% operational by such and such a date. Because if you're not, you're setting yourself up for just a follow-up disaster.
Swerling believes that all expectations shouldn't lie upon the PR team. People should actually see the bigger picture.
People could at least say, you know, this really was a big deal. It was a huge moment in American history. And I think we need to put this in a little bit of context and be a little bit less emotional about it.
The coming months will show whether a properly functioning website can implement the vital parts of this new healthcare law. Amen Oyiboke, Annenberg, Radio News.
This past weekend, Hollywood lost one of its stars. Paul Walker was known for his role in the Fast and the Furious franchise, but to many of his fans, Walker was more than just a Hollywood actor. He was someone they grew up with. Dr. Alan Hilfer is the chief psychologist at Maimonides Medical Center. I spoke with him earlier today about celebrity deaths and why they conjure up such a strong emotional reaction for fans.
People have a tendency to identify parts of themselves with celebrities. They often see celebrities as those people who have managed to achieve a great deal of success and even happiness and fulfillment. So when something terrible happens to a celebrity, it's almost as if a little piece of them has been lost with the celebrity, as well as this real sense of vulnerability, because they feel that celebrities enjoy a special level of protection. And it's sometimes very hard to imagine, as it is with the death of almost any well-known person, the idea that these people can be as vulnerable as the rest of us.
With this case in particular, we see a very strong reaction on social media, with people expressing a great deal of grief. Is this a normal reaction?
I think that it depends upon their level of connectivity to the person who has died. He epitomized a certain level of, you know, derring do and a real sense of flair and flash. And I think people really identified with that fantasy part of themselves, that this was, you know, who they could be like. Plus, they assumed that, you know, this is an actor who knew his way around cars, and for him to die in a car crash is particularly sad and ironic and very tragic for a lot of people.
You know, I must say, I've been even feeling a bit down about this whole ordeal. Is there anything you recommend people in this situation do?
Most of the time, believe it or not, something as simple as talking about it with somebody who's a good listener and who can empathize with one's situation can be extraordinarily helpful. Being able to express your feelings, being able to put them into words, helps us manage them and deal with them.
Do you think it makes any difference that these fans, that they've never even met him, does that make any sort of difference on their emotional, the emotional impact they're going through?
No, I don't think it makes any difference if there's never been any personal contact. The movies give us all the illusion of knowing somebody very well and being intimately involved with them. We mourn their losses in a very special kind of way because they have become a part of our lives, even though we've never had any direct contact with them.
That was Chief Psychologist Dr. Alan Hilfer speaking with us from Brooklyn, New York. This Thursday, cinemas across the nation will be screening a production of Riff Trax Live, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. Riff Trax is a successor to the cult favorite Mystery Science Theater 3000. So why is it called Riff Trax? Angie Sutton has the story.
On December 5th, cinemas across the nation, including several in and around the Los Angeles area, will be screening a production of Riff Trax Live, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Merry Christmas, everyone!
Idiot, you've flown us right into a Christmas movie.
Riff Trax is a spiritual successor to the cult favorite television show Mystery Science Theater 3000, otherwise known as MST3K, and involves MST alums Mike Nelson, Bill Corbett, and Kevin Murphy. In partnership with Fathom Events, this is the 10th such live screening since they started back in 2009. I talked with Mike Nelson about riffing in these live events that he equates to doing a live tour all in one night. For those who aren't familiar with what Riff Trax is and what riffing is, how would you define what a riff is?
Well, we always say it's like watching a movie with your funniest friends, and I hope that's true, and that's kind of the tone that we go for, is we're making fun of it, but it's in a way that hopefully is pretty lighthearted. Otherwise, I can imagine that Riff Trax would grate on your nerves after a while. Guys who were just sort of upset with a movie does not make real funny. I mean, maybe in short doses, but in the long haul, we're all sort of fans of movies and we want to see good movies, but we also really enjoy bad movies in the right way, you know, and then we give them the appropriate commentary. If something is deserving of a bit of scorn, you get that. But if it's otherwise just sort of incompetent, it's just kind of fun to watch and play along with it.
Have you ever riffed a movie that you personally like loved and were a little afraid to take on?
Oh, yes, yes. We did kind of as a stunt to see, and mostly to prove to people that we don't dislike these movies, certainly not strongly. There are things about everything that you, as a critic, kind of would like to change. But we did Casablanca, which is, you know, it's in my top five favorite movies ever. So we don't hold grudges against these movies, and we don't hate them.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
Technically, you're just a minority partner. Good Times Consolidated Hold.
For more information on that story and for the rest of it, check out the website. Now we check in with Alec Lustig to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision.
How you doing, Ani? Good to see ya.
Good to see you, too.
Cool. Well, guess what, guys? We got an interview with Ben Stiller, the Benjamin Stiller. Watch us later tonight. He's going to be talking about directing his new movie. Thanks, guys.
Definitely looking forward to it. Thanks, Alec. Right. That's it for this Tuesday, our last Tuesday show for 2013. Thanks to our Tuesday crew, Zhao Chen, Samantha Chu, Martha Daniel, Asala Sanipour, Madeline Ouels, Amen Oyiboke, Karen Lin, Emmanuel Martinez, Brianna Sachs, Sarah Zahedi, and Victor Figueroa. Graham Clark produces the Arts and Culture segment, and Denise Kerr is the newscast producer. Our executive producer is Catherine Davis, Joel Zink is our technical crew, and many thanks to our friends over at ATVN and Neon Tommy. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Ani Ukar.